May it please the Court. This case is about whether taxpayers have a remedy when their government behaves unconstitutionally. The plaintiff, Ed Taylor, simply seeks judicial recognition of a constitutional injury that is not in dispute here, that before 2005, St. Genevieve County was forced to incur an unfunded mandate in order to comply with the Concealed Carry Act.
So whose injury was it? Whose injury is it?
The injury was suffered by the taxpayers of St. Genevieve County, including Mr. Taylor, who brought the incident claim. And it's a condition that this Court has already found to violate the Hancock Amendment of our Constitution. The facts are clear. Before the legislature amended the law in 2005 to fix the Hancock violations, this Court found the year before in Brooks v. State, there's no dispute that concealed carry endorsements were issued in St. Genevieve County without funding to cover the increased activities and costs the county admits it had to undertake.
Did the county charge these applicants a fee?
Yes.
How much? Did it depend?
It was about $100.
Okay.
However, the original law that was passed in 2003...
And did some of that fee go to the $38 that you have to get the check from the Highway Patrol?
The $38 fee for the fingerprint analysis directly to the state. But the key principle here, Your Honor, Judge Limbaugh, is that the fee that applicants paid went into a revolving fund the county was expressly barred from using for anything but training and equipment. It was not allowed to use those fees to cover the myriad of other activities and costs that the county admits it undertook.
Now, if the county had not charged a fee, would there be any violation? Because I suppose they can do this voluntarily.
But, Your Honor, the law expressly made clear that the county had no choice but to comply. The law said that the county shall...
But that's a different question, is whether they nonetheless chose on their own to do it and voluntarily did it versus being in that Brooks case, the counties did not want to issue those and were forced to do it as opposed to, so we didn't have the question before us in that case of whether a county could voluntarily do it.
Your Honor, in this case, not even the Brooks ruling rendered the county's participation voluntary because this court's ruling in Brooks only enjoined the law as to four counties, leaving the law in effect to the other counties. St. Genevieve County had no choice but to comply with the unfunded mandate. The clear language of the law expressly barred the county from using any of the application fees to pay for the numerous increased activities and costs that it admits.
The county could have elected to absorb all those costs voluntarily.
Your Honor, it could not have. The original language...
I don't know that that's in the record, though, but, you know, so that...
Judge, the language of the original law made mandatory that the county process applications. It made mandatory that the county...
Counsel, we understand that, but you need to understand our question. The fact that it's mandatory that they do it does not mean that they're doing it involuntarily.
Yeah.
Why is it a violation?
An unfunded mandate can still be addressed voluntarily.
The Constitution of our state bars the legislature from requiring counties to perform increased activities without providing full state financing. That's precisely what this court found.
Well, that may have been the dissent in Brooks, but that's why it was called the dissent. There was a majority opinion that it said that the counties could absorb it in other revenues.
The court found that, in fact, the law did mandate an unfunded increased activities without providing adequate funding.
If we were to interpret Brooks to say that you cannot force someone to, you cannot require or mandate someone to spend a county to spend money they don't want to spend, your argument is that since you can't require them to do it, if you try to require them to do it, they can't go ahead and do it voluntarily. And we're saying even if you can't mandate them to do it, why? If here the particular county is willing to spend that money, doesn't look at it as a mandate but as an opportunity, would that violate the unfunded mandate provision, or why would it do so? Because it doesn't necessarily follow logically that because you're mandated to do something, you can't choose to do it voluntarily if otherwise you're given the authority by statute to do it.
I understand, Judge. The fact is it's not clear whether the county chose to spend funds on its own. What we know is that the law required that they do so.
Was there any evidence presented by you back at trial on how much the costs were that was incurred by the sheriff's office? I mean, we have to find it more than de minimis. Was there any specific evidence of what the cost was?
Absolutely, Sheriff Russell. There were numerous admissions by the county. This case did not go to trial, and I think it sort of bears noting that this is an appeal from a summary judgment motion, first before I answer your question directly. And what that means is that all reasonable inferences are to be resolved in favor of the non-moving party, Mr. Taylor.
But were any of your affidavits, did you include any specific figure?
Your Honor, the law, no precedent requires a specific dollar amount. All the law requires is that the evidence show that the increased activities and costs not be speculative and that they not be de minimis. The county's own admissions bear this out. In the responses to admissions, they admit in numerous places to multiple increased activities, multiple increased costs, including a very lengthy list of substantive activities in which they had to engage in order to comply with the Concealed Carry Act.
Well, how did the trial court know then it was more than de minimis and that it wasn't speculative? What evidence did they have to go on in the summary judgment proceeding?
Well, Your Honor, in the responses to admissions, the county admitted to a litany of nearly a dozen increased activities, including conducting criminal background checks, evaluating applicants' attestations as to age, residency, felony status, misdemeanor status, mental competence, reviewing public records to determine whether the applicant posed a danger to himself or others, communicating with applicants about the status of their applications, fingerprinting applicants, a very specific list that is neither speculative nor trivial.
What would be the remedy that you're seeking?
Your Honor, we are seeking declaratory judgment that this law operated unconstitutionally in St. Genevieve County.
Why isn't that moot by the enactment of a new law?
This matter is not made moot by the enactment of the new law, Judge, because...
What does that do? Does that invalidate the permits that were issued under the law?
Yeah, do you want to avoid those permits?
But that can be handled in a separate action. To the extent this court declares that the mandate operated unconstitutionally in St. Genevieve County, an action can be brought to invalidate the permit.
Well, we would declare something if there's no point to it. You need a remedy other than just to declare.
I think that I would submit to you, Judge, that this court's power to declare an action of another branch of government unconstitutional is a very real remedy indeed.
So could we go back and look at laws in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 1800s and issue declarations about their constitutionality? Or would there not be a case in controversy about those because there's nothing... we can't... I think the answer, obviously, is we would not and there would not be a case. Why is this different?
Your Honor, the annals of constitutional law are filled with declaratory judgment actions.
But as to a superseded law, is there any example?
The injury does not disappear simply because the legislature later changed the law.
Okay, how do you address the injury then? Do you void out the permits that were issued during that time period?
That is something that is a possible remedy later on, but all we are seeking, Your Honors, is a declaration, acknowledgement from this court that the mandate operated unconstitutionally in St. Genevieve County.
But you wouldn't be bringing a separate, you wouldn't be able to bring a separate lawsuit then, would you? I mean, isn't...
If this court declares that the mandate operated unconstitutionally in St. Genevieve County, that is certainly one of the options.
But you have, but you've already gotten a remedy. I mean, I don't know. Can you start another lawsuit and start and ask for a separate remedy?
Wouldn't you be splitting your cause of action, if nothing else?
But Your Honor, the point here is that our client, Ed Taylor, seeks this court's recognition that his government behaved unconstitutionally, and that is a real remedy when taxpayers are forced to incur an unfunded...
Let me ask this question. Given the Brooks case and the holding of the majority and the holding of the court, and the feeling that the county could voluntarily assume his expenses, would that voluntary assumption take an act of the county? And if so, what kind of an act? And was there any such act here?
Here, it is clear that the county didn't or there's no evidence that the county engaged in these activities voluntarily. And let's remember that in summary judgment,
but they didn't take any action to say they are doing it voluntarily. Did he take any action to say they're voluntarily doing this, or just the sheriff doing it is enough?
The sheriff had no discretion to decide whether to.
Yes, he did. After the ruling in Brooks came down, the sheriff could have desisted from issuing permits, but continued to do so. So we have to think that that was voluntary, at least, because we told him that he did not have to do it.
Except the clear language of the law was still in force in the state of Missouri until the legislature changed the law.
No, actually, when the Supreme Court declares a statute unconstitutional, it goes back to being void at the time of the enactment.
What we said was that an unfunded mandate is improper under that, and to the extent it required that, it's inappropriate, but there was no evidence as to whether, in fact, there were unfunded mandates in other counties, as to which there was no showing whether or not their expenses were de minimis or more than that. And that's why the questions today about whether there was a showing there were more than de minimis costs, and also why it matters now, because in when Brooks, it was we enjoined enforcement of the statute. Since you didn't ask for injunctive relief until after the new statute came into effect, it's unclear to me, other than, as you say, sort of a general statement of what a superseded law said, what the purpose is of continuing here, why it wasn't mooted out.
It's about checks and balances, Your Honor. The Hancock Amendment exists as a check on the legislature exceeding its authority and imposing unfunded costs on taxpayers.
And why doesn't the ruling in Brooks do that?
Because it does not apply to St. Genevieve County. And if they can violate this constitutional provision, as long as they later change it in the future, where does that leave the status of aggrieved taxpayers like Mr. Taylor during the time period in which the unfunded mandate was in effect?
Counsel, your time's up, but there's another question.
Why isn't your remedy to require the state to reimburse St. Genevieve County for the expenses that were incurred because of the unfunded mandate?
Your Honor, the Hancock Amendment is just to protect taxpayers from unfunded mandates. That is one possible remedy in the future, but what we are seeking is this court's acknowledgement, a simple declaration that, in fact, it operated unconstitutionally. And that is essential to the checks and balances.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Taylor's petition sought two very specific kinds of relief. First, he asked for a declaration that the concealed weapons statute was unconstitutional and therefore void. Second, he asked that all of the permits that were issued under that statute in St. Genevieve County be declared likewise void. Neither of those forms of relief are available in...
What about having the state reimburse... St. Genevieve County for the unfunded mandate?
Well, under Port
expenses
Zumwalt,
incurred under the
under the Port Zumwalt case, the state is not liable for that sort of money damages under the unfunded mandate provisions of the Hancock Amendment, because there's nothing in it that specifically sets aside sovereign immunity, which would be necessary in order to enter money judgment.
Well, but that would be a money judgment as to particular private parties. I'm talking about the entity of the government itself.
Now, Fort Zumwalt says you can't make the state pay for those expenses because sovereign immunity has not been waived. Fort Zumwalt says that it is a sufficient remedy to enter a declaratory judgment removing the mandate from the political subdivision.
And that's really the only remedy that is specified in the Constitution, is
that's
declaratory
correct,
judgment.
The Hancock Amendment is a shield. It's not a sword.
You agree that the Constitution says that the remedy is a declaratory judgment.
That's correct. Yeah. A declaratory judgment that they need not, although they may, comply.
Well, why wouldn't it? That's all she's asking for here is a declaratory judgment.
Well, no, that's
which is permitted under the Constitution. That's the one thing that's permitted is a remedy under the Constitution.
But the declaration she wants is that the statute was void ab initio. And that's not the statute, that's not the remedy that the Hancock Amendment permits. The Hancock Amendment only permits the remedy removing the mandate, leaving the law in force, leaving the law in play and removing the mandate from the political subdivisions that it must comply, although leaving them in a situation in which they may comply, which is exactly what happened here. The four counties in which this court found evidence sufficient to give this declaratory judgment in Brooks, all four of them went ahead and issued permits before the General Assembly changed the statute.
According to Brooks, though, did they take any action voluntarily? Was there any official action saying we'll pick up the cost or we're going to do this? Was there any action, or is it enough to say they did it anyway? They did whatever.
Well, first of all, I think it is enough to say, judging from their actions, that there is an inference that they chose voluntarily, given that the court's ruling in Brooks was so clear. But in this case, in St. Genevieve County, the county went ahead and paid for a package of software that would allow the sheriff to process these applications. We don't know how much that cost, but that was paid not out of the revolving fund, but out of the general revenue fund of the county. Not by a decision of the sheriff, but by a decision of the county. That's an affirmative action, Judge Tyler, I believe, of the sort that you're looking for.
Right.
It shows they're volunteering to assume these costs in order to provide the service that the law allows them to provide.
How is the opposing counsel's argument, declaratory judgment argument, affected by the fact that amendatory legislation has been passed?
Well, at first blush, that looks to be the key fact, and certainly the court could reach that question. But the truth is that even if the legislature had never acted, the plaintiff would not be entitled to an order finding that the permits that were issued in St. Genevieve County were void, nor would she be entitled to a declaratory judgment that the underlying statute was void.
You're saying the declaration would only have future effect, and so it can't affect things that have already been done under the statute prior to the court's judgment?
The declaration is limited to removing the mandate, removing the compulsion.
So
it doesn't invalidate the law.
And so is there no, say this was something where a county had been mandated to buy some kind of million-dollar equipment or something, some other, and so they brought this action, but they'd already expended the money. There's no mechanism for them to get that money back or any other kind of expenditures back?
No.
Not just in this context, but in general.
Right. In any case in which, there is no way to get a judgment from the state for money spent pursuant to an unfunded mandate. That's why you have the power to bring the action ahead.
That's why you can seek injunctive relief.
An injunction and or a declaration that the
declaratory relief is the only relief that the plaintiff can seek. And if declaratory relief is granted, then there's also attorney's fees under the Hancock.
Correct. Correct.
I know your argument is that the plaintiff's failed to prove any specific facts, unlike in Brooks, where it was found to be $150,000 in cost.
Right.
If, in fact, she'd been able to prove or did allege specific damages and costs, how would that change the case?
If there had been evidence of actual costs, more than de minimis costs, she would have been entitled to only what the plaintiffs in Brooks got. And that's a declaration that St. Genevieve County didn't have to comply, although it may comply if it wished, which it did. So, in effect,
why isn't that moot? Not because she didn't seek the injunctive relief until after the new statute was already in effect.
And then we get to the effect of House Bill 365, Your Honor, and that's correct there, because there could be no proof of a violation once that statute was amended, because they cured any violation that there may have been. Now, there is also the issue. In doing that, the General Assembly said that this court was wrong and had misread the statute in Brooks, that there never was a Hancock.
Can a later legislature declare what an earlier legislature, which would have been made up of different persons, intended?
Well,
could they go back and say, here's what we meant in 1920 or in 1880, if they could do it here?
I think the answer is that the General Assembly is at least as competent as any other branch to make a decision about what a General Assembly meant. It is their ability.
Is there a case you can cite for that?
No. Other than the cases that arose out of the common law context for the repeal of sovereign immunity, no. This is a first time attempt by the General Assembly to say not only...
I'm not aware of anything saying legislature has the authority to interpret the meaning of earlier statutes.
Well, that power is, I mean, that power was assumed by the General Assembly and used in this instance. If the court declares that it doesn't exist, you speak last.
Do we need to reach that?
No, of course not, Your Honor. First, because it doesn't matter whether they amend the statute or not, she can't get what was pled in the petition. And second, the amendment clearly, because she sought no relief and got no relief before the amendment is the controlling law in terms of when this judgment was entered, and the amendment precludes any finding of Hancock violence, security of utter.
Now, that is somewhat maybe hypothetical, beyond the Hancock Amendment and the remedies of the declaratory judgment. But if there is if the legislature passed a law that violated people's civil rights and they had damages, and then we as a court said that law was unconstitutional, it would go back, it would be void. But what would happen to people's claims and when the law was unconstitutional? If people had damages about the wouldn't they be able to claim something in that regard?
Yes.
At the end of that, they can't retroactively cure everything.
No, they cannot. And here, the issue that led to a finding that the Hancock Amendment had been violated was this court's construction of the statute in terms of what the fund could be used to pay for. Now, they take issue with this court's conclusion, and so they said we're fixing it going forward, but by the way, it was never meant to be read that narrowly. But again, that's your case, Your Honor, where there is a substantive violation of the Constitution. Damaged plaintiffs are entitled to money judgments under state and federal law, under waivers of sovereign immunity, under 1983 and 1988 causes of action. So, and those can't be done away with by a subsequent enactment of the General Assembly.
And when plaintiff filed their suit in March of 2005, it was clearly before the effective date of the new legislation in July of 2005. So her suit was not moot at that point.
Well, that's correct. The while the bill had passed one house, it had not been passed by both houses of the Senate. The St. Genevieve County went forward an entire year under Brooks, and it was only when the bill fixing this statute passed one house nearly unanimously that plaintiffs brought this cause of action and still took no further action in court, didn't seek a temporary restraining order, didn't seek a preliminary injunction, took no action until after the statute was passed.
Now, we had a situation where I think it was Southwest and Bell was being sued over some fees, and then the legislature passed a statute saying those cases don't count. You know, we're going to retroactively say they just don't count. I think we found in favor of the people already sued. So there is some limitation on the retroactive.
That limitation it also specifically protects the cities from having causes of action taken away from them by the state. So there are portions of the Constitution that speak specifically to this. But it's not that the General Assembly took away her cause of action. The Declaratory Judgments Act is still there. They took away the basis for her cause of action. They took away the underlying factual premise that there was a Hancock violation. Even if they hadn't done that, again, Your Honor, all they would be entitled to is a declaration that they need not comply with the statute, although they may still voluntarily do.
Why isn't that enough for attorney's fees?
Pardon?
Why isn't that enough as a premise for attorney's fees?
Because the attorney has delivered nothing for the client. There has been no benefit. The suit isn't sustained.
Is the essence of your argument that combined with sovereign immunity, that declaratory judgment can only provide prospective relief, that is a declaration that a county no longer need not comply with a law that is unfunded, and that is only a viable form of relief until the statute is amended to correct it?
Yes, Your Honor, but let me also add that I think it's important to note what the declaration says. There are declarations that a statute is void, and then there are arguments that arise as to whether that's retrospective or prospective.
And here it's not that it's void, it's just that it cannot be mandated
exactly
without funding. And once funding is provided, then there's no longer a prospective relief that could
be
available.
Mandated, but the law is still there.
So had this lawsuit been brought sooner, it would have been a viable lawsuit. prior to Brooks.
It could have led to the same declaration this court issued with respect to those four counties, but the county could have gone ahead and issued permits, as did the four counties in Brooks, without any subsequent statutory amendment.
Yeah, as we said in Brooks, the only ruling in Brooks is that the counties are not required to comply with the Act.
But may do so if they wish.
Well, we left that open. I've got it here. Mm-hmm. Parties do not raise, nor do we address the question of whether the county's governing body can still elect to fund increased costs on a voluntary basis.
Yes, that question was left open, but that question is addressed in prior cases, including the Jefferson City case versus DNR, and other cases where the court found voluntary compliance not to be a Hancock issue. As long as there is a choice given to the political subdivision, you don't have an unfunded mandate.
Is it your position that once this court found the Hancock violation with respect to the original statute, that other parties seeking the same relief, it's redundant, there's no relief needed because there's already been a declaration?
Because there isn't a justiciable controversy.
We clearly indicated in Brooks that you could bring, if your costs are more than de minimis, you could bring an action to enjoin it in any county. They simply didn't have any evidence about the cost.
Right.
But so immediately after Brooks, suit could have been brought in every county, shown what you spent if it was more than de minimis. They also would not have been able to be mandated to spend that money.
But that suit would have had to have been brought by somebody who could colorably claim that the state was compelling them.
Right.
And the state
that's a different question.
And in fact, we've been over backwards telling counties, you are not required. So I don't believe they could have.
We've had taxpayer suits on a case that regarding Planned Parenthood 5-10 years later. We're much more open to it than Frothingham versus Mellon. Our taxpayers, but Hancock does provide for taxpayer suits.
It allows taxpayers to sue in certain circumstances and only for certain relief. Before I run out of time, Ron, I want to underscore some serious deficiencies in the record that came up during the appellant's argument. First of all, there is no evidence in the record that any permits were issued prior to the amendment of the statute. There is no evidence in the record as to what the fee was, whether it was $1 or $100. There is no evidence in the record as to how
much. I thought it was a $100 fee.
It's up to $100. The sheriff sets the fee, and there's nothing in this record that says what the fee was in St. Genevieve. There's no evidence in the record that there were any costs other than this one software package incurred, any specific costs incurred by the county or by the sheriff under his fund. The sheriff said specifically there were no additional hours required, there was no overtime required, there were no specific costs illustrated in the factual record on summary judgment at all.
Is there anything in the record about the cost of the software program?
Of the
software program?
No, only that there was one and that it was paid not out of the revolving fund but out of the general revenue.
Did I understand from the prior argument that the $38 for the fingerprint check was not paid by the county but paid by the applicant?
That's correct. Paid directly to the highway patrol by the applicant.
Okay.
So again, that was significant in Brooks and mm-hmm. missing all the completely. Thank you.
I'd like to raise three points concerning the standard retroactivity and the remedy. First, I'd like to address counsel's argument that nothing in the record indicated that any permits were issued. In fact, the answer to request for admission number two, Chair Greer Stolzer issued concealed carry permits, endorsements to residents of St. Genevieve County admitted.
And does it say when, before or after the new legislation?
All of these were prior to the new legislation.
It was answered prior?
Everything in this case concerns permits issued prior to the new legislation. And that goes to the issue of retroactivity.
Did it say how many, or is it just a yes, permits were issued?
Yes, permits were issued. Moreover, in requests 13 and 14 say that they admitted to increased activities, plural, in order to comply with the law. 15, 16, 46, and 47, that they admit to additional costs that they incurred
doing so. Admissions 20 and 36 through 45 list that list of 10 or 11 increased activities that they admit to engaging in. Again, these are hardly speculative, nor trivial, nor remedial. The law only requires that they be non-speculative and more than de minimis. That threshold has clearly been met. But to the extent you are not convinced that their admission of increased costs isn't enough to rise above de minimis, you can remand for further fact-finding as to the nature of those costs. This is an appeal from summary judgment. What that means is that all inferences are to be inferred to Mr. Taylor. They don't get the inference that the costs are de minimis. We get the inference that they're not de minimis.
Why would you do that? Don't you have to prove they're not de minimis? So if you don't respond to their claim that they were, then we assume you can't, unless you ask for additional discovery?
We believe the record shows that the costs are clearly not de minimis. But remember, this is an appeal from summary judgment. If they have not proven that there is no dispute of material fact and that they are entitled to judgment as a matter of law with all inferences in our favor, you must reverse. Their admission of increased costs alone.
So you're saying if their admissions raise a fact question as to whether it was de minimis or more, then we resolve it in your favor?
At the least, Your Honor, we believe that they raise a fact question as not only to whether these admitted increased costs, with the inference in our favor, that alone bar summary judgment.
Let me ask
as well
you,
as the issue of voluntariness.
Assuming we agree with your argument that that's right, still, since the only remedy available is a prospective remedy, isn't it too late to consider those prior increased costs and activities?
I see my time is almost up. May I answer?
Yes.
Your Honor, the Constitution has never been read to say that a court cannot acknowledge a constitutional injury that occurs, that it can just disappear, that citizens lack redress when the government behaves unconstitutionally if they later fix the law for future circumstances. That injury exists and will continue to exist until acknowledged by this court. The courts have long held that any constitutional injury, no matter how small, no matter for how short a period of time, constitutes irreparable harm. The facts of this case clearly show that we have met the threshold in Brooks, and to the extent you believe that further fact-finding is an issue, you can remand it.
I believe there's one more question.
Do you have a case law to the effect that, as Judge Price raised, declaratory judgments are retrospective, and there's value in on the part of the plaintiff in having a law declared unconstitutional, at least that person feels that they've been justice has been done. Do you have any case of what you're saying about declaring a statute unconstitutional just for the fact that it's unconstitutional?
Our Constitution bars retroactive application of a law if it takes away a vested right. And here, Mr. Taylor's right vested.
Are there any cases that allow declaratory judgments of act as to the invalidity of laws that are no longer in effect?
So, for example, the Airy case that's cited in I think both of the parties' briefs, the court found that Mrs. Airy had acquired a vested interest in a punitive damage award, even though the legislature later repealed the punitive damage award law because they found that her interest vested at the before
right.
the time the law was changed.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up. The case is submitted.